Off the Ball Breakfast.
How's your golf? And this is my favourite answer. How's your golf? My golf is where it should be. It's proportional to the amount of practice I'm putting in, which isn't a lot.
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Connacht, Leinster, Munster and Ulster Rugby. Never stop competing.
Now then, Brendan Fanning has an absolutely fantastic new book out. It's called Touching Distance, Irish Rugby's Battle with Great Expectations. Very happy to say Brendan is with us in studio. Brendan Fanning, you're very welcome. How are you?
I'm good, Owen. How are you getting on?
All good. This book is a sequel. Am I right in saying that?
Yes. Bit of a gap between Ivrahain and Ivrahdoh. The gap wasn't supposed to be that long, but yes, it is a sequel.
Because From There to Here was published in 2007, the story of the early years, really, of Irish amateurism. And this is the leap from, I guess, from 2007 onwards. It feels like you've left a very meaty year of 2007 hanging there for a number of years, like one of the most interesting years to cover as a rugby journalist.
Yeah, I can't adequately explain that.
Yeah.
Why it took me so long. I felt for a while that 2007 was so toxic and there were so many accounts of it that people just didn't have the appetite for it. But I had to use that as the launch point again. And luckily, in the course of that, I was able to bring a couple of new things to it. One being, everybody knew we were undercooked going to the World Cup in 2007, and that's why we bombed in the pool. What people didn't appreciate was that we were supposed to have a warm-up game against South Africa, and that got wiped off the schedule. Nobody knew why or how. So I was able to tell the story behind that, which was that there was a World Cup vote where the South Africans thought they had Ireland sealed for their support, and they hadn't. And then when it turned out that Ireland voted for New Zealand and not for South Africa, the South Africans were very, very, very angry. And I remember talking to some of them at the time and they were apoplectic. So that didn't do anything for South African-Irish relations. And nobody can point to a date or a phone call where the game suddenly disappeared. But Eddie O'Sullivan, who's the head coach, and Dr. Liam Hennessy, who's the head of fitness, both understood that the game was going to be part and parcel of their prep, and suddenly it was gone. And neither can explain adequately why they didn't replace it.
Mm.
So then that whole thing began to fall apart. And then we ended up with that mad game stuffed into the schedule down in Bayonne.
So that was instead of the South Africa game?
Well, it was instead. It was a knee-jerk reaction.
Okay.
Jesus, we need a game. What are we going to do? We're going down to train in France. Let's get a game against the locals. I'll never forget that night.
We there?
Yes. And I remember I was covering it for The Guardian because it wasn't a Saturday game. It wasn't for the Sunday Indo. Okay. So I was free to work for The Guardian during the week.
I see. Because I was going to ask you which publication you were working for at the time. Yeah. So you were working for both.
I think it was a Friday night.
Okay.
Possibly a Thursday night. Anyway, Brian O'Driscoll was king hit with boxing behind. It was desperate. And there was chaos out. We were in the kind of a courtyard outside the changing rooms in the club in Bayonne. And there's crowds milling about the place. And the next thing, the door comes out and Eddie O'Sullivan marches out. And I just made eye contact with him and he just kind of just gave me that look. And Brian O'Driscoll is coming out with his hand up to his eye, holding a ice pack or whatever it was. And I'm on the phone to The Guardian trying to do an update on the story. And I'm thinking, there's no way that guy's going to be playing in the World Cup.
Wow.
He had a fractured sinus, which I didn't think was possible.
Like, is that even a bone?
Yes. But anyway, that was the kind of an apt illustration of how awful that piece of planning was.
Oh my God. Like, and the flip side of it is that South Africa ended up playing Connacht.
Yeah, which is brilliant.
Yeah.
I thought at the time it was a fingers up to the IRFU saying, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go play those guys over in the West Coast. We're not going to play you in Lansdowne Road. We're not going to give you the money you would have got from that game. We're going to play in front of 3,000 or 4,000 people in a midweek game. And that suited the South Africans fine. That they didn't want any more big games on their schedule. So the provincial game against Connacht suited them fine.
Yeah. How far out from the proposed game against South Africa was that vote? Like
A couple of years. That was 2005.
Okay.
Ahead of the 2011 World Cup,
okay,
which the Kiwis won.
Yes.
And the Kiwis were very, very, very keen to get that because they sussed that that was going to be the last World Cup that was given out to a relatively small country.
Because it was going to go supernova after that.
Correct.
And how far before the fixture was due to be played did South Africa pull out of the one in 2007?
We could, nobody can say.
Okay.
And everybody acknowledges that it was there, but nobody can say, you know, who took the tore that page out of the book or when it happened.
Because it's such an unknown. I think to be fair, as much as we don't like to admit it, it is nearly 20 years since the 07 World Cup. So there's going to be a lot of people who come to this book and maybe are learning about these things for the first time. But I think Bayonne probably stays in the memory quite a bit. The industrial estate in Bordeaux is very, very famous. But the South African angle is lost in time, really. It's certainly not the first thing I would think of when I think of 07.
I spoke to, they were off the record conversations, so I can't identify who these people were on the South African side. But they were absolutely going crazy. And I relayed some of this craziness to Noel Murphy, who was perhaps the biggest hitter in the Irish scene at that stage in the IRFU, and I'll never forget him screeching down the phone at me, "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, you can't print that." This was exactly what he said. So, it was a great time. It was a great time to be writing about it.
Yeah,
because it was a bit like with From There to Here. There was just car crash after car crash. You know, you couldn't. You had loads of stuff to be writing about.
That's the thing. Like in many ways, it's. The romanticism of the amateurism that might still have existed at boardroom level is something that we all still hold. Like it's a very, or seemingly quite a slick operation nowadays. If you're writing about the 2027 World Cup preparations, I dare say they wouldn't hold a candle to some of the stories that you would have got ahead of the 2007 Rugby World Cup.
I would hope so. And certainly the fellas going to France in 2023 wanted for nothing.
Yeah.
That was actually the best illustration of how good we could be regarding our preparation, and the depth of our squad wasn't bad. It was probably better than any of our previous World Cups. But the players had everything they could possibly want. Everything was looked after, and credit to all the coaching team. They did a really good job. And when you compare it to some of the stuff that had gone on before. And 07... 03 was pretty good under Eddie, planning wise, and then just that disaster in 07. God, anyway,
the Genesis report afterwards, it seems to underline the idea that anything other than a semi-final place was complete failure for this team. Which I'm not sure is that an overly ambitious target. Is it a sense of arrogance? But that is certainly what we took from the Genesis report.
And it was reasonable because given the form.
Yeah, they just beat England.
Yeah,
we'd
won three triple crowns in the previous four seasons. You know, why shouldn't we be going to the last four? And the funny thing is, in all 10 failures to get where you want to go in the last World Cup, it's always something different. It's not as if one stone has been left unturned repeatedly and it keeps tripping us up over and over again. It's always something different. And sometimes you could say in 2023, it was Jordy Barrett getting his fat, fleshy thigh under the ball when Ronan Kelleher was trying to make contact with the ground. So,
is that a more acceptable way for us to have our hearts broken, or is actually the Omni Shambles of 07 a more palatable thing, given Ireland were so far off the mark?
Well, there was no toxicity in France in 2023.
No.
I will never forget the toxicity in if that's a word, in 07. It was horrible.
When did you first realise that this was going to become that? Because the Battle of Bayonne is unfortunate. It's poor planning, I guess. Not identifying that these French guys are going to want to beat up the Irish before their home World Cup begins. But in terms of the toxic nature, when people started to turn on one another, When does that become apparent during this World Cup?
Well, we opened up against Namibia.
Yeah,
I remember talking to some people from World Rugby in the lead up to the tournament, and they were working overtime trying to get the Namibians up to speed so that the optics wouldn't be too bad. And the line was, you know, we're hopeful of being competitive for 60 minutes, and then, you know, Ireland will stick 20 or 30 on us in the last 20, but we can live with that. But that didn't happen. Like, Ireland came within... Oh, no, I mean, they won by 20-something points, but it was obvious there was something wrong.
Yeah, it was laboured.
And then the Georgians, oh, I was working for the Guardian that night as well, and it was on the whistle. With the way I'll explain that, you would do a top and a tail to the report, or you would at the very end, but you would file a meaty chunk at half-time.
Yeah.
So... suddenly, the meaty chunk that I'd filed at half-time bore no relation to me having to say Ireland have just got out of the World Cup hands of Georgia. And it all came down to a referee's decision, a TMO's decision, on a line-out maul that ended up over the Irish line. Was it a Georgian try? Was it not? And I'm sitting in the back of the stand and my heart had stopped beating at this stage and the blood had gone from my face. And I said, I was just thinking... if there's a God in the world, let this be a no. So they survived that, and by that stage, they were done.
Your penultimate paragraph: for nearly 10 minutes, Ireland were watching their lives pass in front of them. I dare say Brendan Fanning was also watching his life pass in front of him at that moment. An extraordinary couple of weeks. The day after it is officially ended, when Ireland are put out of their misery, Argentina, there's a press conference the next day.
Yeah.
I hadn't realised this.
That you said, this is the photograph.
Where Eddie looks like he is close to being finished in his role. But also the room isn't full of just journalists.
No. Richard Cooper was doing very well at the time, mimicking all sorts, but he did Eddie brilliantly. And I don't know what his gig was with RTE, if he was going around the tournament doing colour pieces or whatever, but for some reason he was at this press conference. And... Eddie was struggling to explain what had happened, and then Richard pipes up with, "Eddie, are you a croc, monsieur?" And I'm sitting there thinking, "Christ, what is this?"
The day after Ireland had been knocked out of the World Cup.
Yeah, and I said, I honestly thought Eddie was just going to come across the table and strangle him with his bare hands, which is exactly what I would have done if I had been in Eddie's shoes. And he, I don't know how he retained pretty stoic appearance and reaction. And that, and there was a photograph, I think the photograph was after the France game, I think. And in the way that photographers run around looking for exit signs and taking photographs of politicians with the exit sign over them, this was kind of rugby's equivalent. It was hastily put together in a corridor, and Eddie was literally backed up against the wall and hemmed in by all the photographers and journos, and just the whole thing was awful. And if you remember, it was the height of the Celtic Tiger. So the opening night in Bordeaux, sun was beating down. Yeah, it was still very warm, 7:30 kickoff, whatever. And the concourse all around Chaban Delmas was just heaving. All Irish people over there, all on the lash, all with loads of money to spend. Gimme, 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 I want more. Loads of them had pretty little connection with rugby, but they had the money to spend. Let's go on a trip to the World Cup. We're going to win. And then when it wasn't happening, the reaction was awful.
Yeah, that's such a good point, what it actually represented at that time. And look, we had the same thing in 2023 in terms of the volume of Irish that were there, but that felt like a more positive thing. Simply because the results on the pitch were much better.
Yes.
And it became like, I don't know, I used the phrase at the time myself, but it kind of became something of an Italian 90 for this generation because they've been so starved of international success.
And it was the same in 2015 in terms of the numbers of supporters travelling. I'll never forget the game against France, which ultimately did for us in 2015 because of injuries and suspensions that fed into the defeat by Argentina. But I was never a huge fan of Ireland's call, but I will never forget the rendition of that before the game in
before the France game.
Yeah, it was, jeez, it was staggering. Like, the noise was just unreal.
Yeah.
But in the fallout from that tournament, Joe Schmidt got a bit of criticism, and Ireland got criticism and whatever at the speed with which it fell apart against the Pumas. But it was nothing like 07.
Just wondered, was Richtard doing the press conferences after every game? Was
he? I don't remember him after every game. He may well have been there.
I just can't. Like, imagine in an IRFU press conference today if an impersonator went in and started impersonating the head coach.
Yeah, well,
especially after they've just been dumped out of the World Cup.
Yeah. You asked that question. Do you remember Michael Checa, who coached Leinster?
Of course.
That would have had a whole different finish.
You obviously had quite a good relationship with Eddie. I mean, you tell the story in the book that you did the gentlemanly thing of just giving him the tip off that you got information that he was going to be on the chopping block in 2008.
I did. A colleague of mine was jealous of that working relationship, but he said, "Oh, you're mate or your buddy." And I said, "He's not my buddy. We don't socialise. He doesn't even know the names of my kids." Yeah, you know, we weren't mates.
Yeah,
but I knew him a long time, way back to. I remember him he was a fitness coach on a tour to Namibia, which was the first tour I ever covered back in 1991. And I knew him on the scene because he was a development officer with the IRFU. So, it was an awkward phone call. And I'd done the story again. This is turning into a great promo for The Guardian. I'd done the story for The Guardian and I filed it on the Friday. It was going to appear on the morning of the game in Twickenham. And I thought, geez, I know the guy, Yonks. And I didn't want to be blindsided by this. And in any case, he had a fair idea what was coming. Mm. So I just rang him and said, look, bit of bad news, you're for the chop. And it was a very short phone call. And then when he wrote his own book sometime later, I remember I went to the launch of it and he said, yeah, I remember that phone call. Listen, by the way, I didn't say it at the time, but I appreciated the call.
You know? Right. It felt that was the end of a certain era of, you know, that sort of opportunity being afforded to a coach from a journalist and also sort of the opportunities that were afforded to the media on behalf of, you know, the Irish national team head coach to have a fairly open relationship. I'm not sure that changed much under Kidney, but it certainly changed a lot under Schmidt. Was Kidney a transition phase, I wonder, for Irish journalists and the relationship with the media?
I know I didn't do a chapter on Declan Kidney, and several people have said, why not? I didn't think that he had the seismic effect on playing squads that Joe did or that Stuart Lancaster did. He made a pretty quick transformation to Leinster. I like Declan and I kind of get on with him. But man, he is very, very, very hard work.
Yeah.
Particularly to journals, because he plays his cards so close to his chest. And he's a really solid bloke and has made a great contribution to Irish rugby, but he was a nightmare to deal with.
Okay.
You couldn't get a good line out of him.
So it was just brick wall as opposed to any it was just sort of real. Just,
and I'm pretty selfish in that regard. I love dealing with people who are open and givish, and my patience threshold is not brilliant for people who aren't open and givish.
Yeah.
That's the nature of the business.
I think we're all the same to a degree. We're selfish in that way that you know, we'd love for somebody to be giving the whole time. Can I ask them, like, with Schmidt, was it always tricky enough? Like, I mean, personally, I wouldn't have covered a Joe Schmidt press conference really until the latter end of his career, like 2018, 2019. So I got the tail end when he was very, very aware of, you know, the way he's being viewed and of what he's trying to give to the public. Was he always that way?
Yes.
Okay.
100%.
Because you say in the book that back in New Zealand he was seen as a softer individual.
Yes. And I spoke to Tom McCartney, who a lot of Connacht people would remember. He was a Aucklander who did about 6 or 7 seasons in Connacht. But Tom had come across him when he was some way down the pecking order in Auckland. And Joe was an assistant coach. And Joe helped get him up the ladder. So he always thought very well of Joe. But At the same time, he thought, I'm not sure Joe is really cut out for this because he's just such a nice guy.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's an astonishing quote about Joe Schmidt, because that has never been levelled at him in this country. And I mean that in the best way possible.
He is a very nice fella. But there are two Joes. There's the Joe, I tell you, I remember interviewing him one time in the Berkeley Court, the old Berkeley Court, which is now apartments, I think. Yes, it is. Anyway, and it wasn't a private room. It was just tucked away in a corner of the foyer. And it was stupid. I should have tried to get a private area because Joe was at the height of his fame at this stage. And everybody wanted to come over and get a piece of him. And there was this old geezer came over and Joe starts entertaining him and chatting him. And I was saying, Joe, for Christ's sake. He was unfailingly polite. Everybody loved him. And understandably so, because he had, at the time, he was the highest profile sports coach on the island. There wasn't any GA guy to touch him in terms of his impact on the public. And he had transformed Leinster. Michael Checa was at the wheel when they won their first Heineken Cup in 2009. But Joe absolutely moved it on and moved on every element of it. And he did the same thing with the Ireland team. He was all over everything. Like, Joe's the type of bloke who'd want to pick the soundtrack on the bus on the way to the game.
Right.
He is unbelievably controlling. He has a phenomenal capacity for detail. He's a very, very intelligent man. And I found him good to deal with. But I always understood this conversation is on Joe's terms, not mine. So I just take what I can get from it.
Mm. How did Joe fit into what I would suggest are the remnants of the culture from the 90s and 2000s in terms of rugby administration in this country? Did that ever irk him? Did that ever impact him in any way? Because while the game went professional, obviously, in 1995, it still took a while for those at boardroom level to maybe get up to speed with what's required in terms of moving rugby on.
He was blessed and Declan was unlucky in that Joe replaced Declan in 2013 and David Nusafour came in 2014. So the stuff that Declan had to put up with before David Nusafour came in was unreal. Mm. Absolutely head-wrecking. So he would have had to deal with the night before the game being interviewed by some committee men about the match plan for the next day, that kind of stuff.
So did that only end in 2014?
Yes.
Right.
I know, it beggars belief. It absolutely beggars belief. It used to drive Warren Gatland mad, and that's going back a while. So also our open door policy with NIQs, non-Ireland qualifiers, was crazy. So Declan's trying to pick an Ireland team when there's maybe two possible tight head prop choices available to him. If one of them gets sick, he's like, that's why John Hayes, it was wrap him up. And that all changed. So one of David Nusafour's really positive effects in this country was to support the national coach. And Declan would have had a different experience if Nusafour had been here, 3 years earlier.
Yeah.
And Joe benefited from that. Joe was only getting to grips with it when the noose arrived. And the two of them were hard arses. The two of them were driven. The two of them were very good on detail. They understood high performance. And they were the most powerful men in all. Everyone else in the IRVU was just running around the two of them.
On Nusafour, is there a but coming at the end of that sentence?
No. And back to the selfishness, he wouldn't play ball with me. And it wasn't just me. It was
everyone.
It was everyone. And the reason was, he's actually good company, as I discovered when I caught up with him for the book.
Okay.
But he arrived in and said, okay, I need him and my team. This is what I want to do. This is my plan. These are the people I'm going to need on my side in order to do this. I don't have time for anybody else. I was in the latter category. So do I want to take a call from this guy? No, I don't.
Yeah.
So that went on and on and on. He repeatedly tried to get... I got him, I think, twice in the 10 years. And he was good when I got him. But the only reason I got him was because it suited him to get a point across and that wouldn't be the case the following week. And then I got him, I approached him for the book, thinking it would probably be more of the same, but hoping for something different. And it was something different because he didn't sign an NDA on his way out the door.
Okay.
And that was pretty unusual.
Right.
So as guy as bright and careful as he is, didn't sign an NDA because he wanted to shape the narrative after he'd gone.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. That is obviously something that he has been super aware of then, about the narrative around him. And it was kind of a backseat approach to how he was being reported on. He would do his maybe one briefing per year.
Exactly.
But that was kind of it.
Then he'd scoop all the stuff and he'd be up and then he'd be gone.
Yeah.
But he wasn't as... he is a pretty raw, a pretty tough hide. He really has. He took a lot of abuse in Australia before he came over here, having done a similar gig in the ARU. Joe would be wounded by what was written. And Joe could recite chapter and verse. I don't think David Nusifora could.
Okay, that's a critical difference. The legacy, though, is a positive one of Nusifora, you think?
In some regards, not in the women's game, it isn't, because we spent a lot of time focusing on sevens because the Olympics was the driver, and that's understandable. But it came at the cost of the 15s because there simply aren't enough women playing the game to service both.
Yeah.
So time was lost on that. Time they're going to have to try and make up. Moreover, I think he was open to, in fairness to him, I think he was open to change. He didn't believe necessarily that the women's game should be a copy and paste of the men's game, which I think is the right way to look at it. It is a copy and paste, and that's a mistake. And he couldn't drive that on. It was the only case that I'm aware of Owen in his 10 years here where he was confounded by the committee. There were too many people saying, no, you're not going to do this around the women's game.
Okay.
And that's why they didn't tear it all up and start again, that they kept going with the same, the clubs, the provinces, the national team model, and et cetera, et cetera. But that's just my reading of it. And I'd like to stress, I am not an expert on women's rugby.
Just to kind of close the loop on the Joe Schmidt story, obviously the 2007 becomes the end game for Eddie O'Sullivan in many ways. We knew it was going to be the end game for Joe Schmidt going into 2019 and that World Cup. Your own perspective on that World Cup, like as somebody who was there and who covered it, it very much felt like positivity every press conference. Everything seemed rosy in the garden. If you just listened to what everybody at the top table was saying, game in, game out, press conference in, press conference out, in stark contrast to maybe the cracks that were appearing in 2007. And yet there was still an early shock result when they lose to Japan. Was that one of those kind of like duck analogy moments where everything on the surface level feels serene, but actually behind the scenes things were failing about?
Well, look, everybody, not everybody, but lots of us were concerned about the slide that would have started after Paddy's Day in 2018 when we won the Grand Slam. It was never the same again. And I was rattled by the opening game against England in the Six Nations the following season, and they hit us for two tries in the first few minutes. And I said to Joe for the book, did you not go, oh, wow, this is what's up here? And he dismissed it immediately and said, no, look, you don't appreciate test swing on the smallest, you know, butterfly flaps his wings in Singapore, we lose the test match type of thing, which to a degree is true, but Ireland were definitely on the slide. And interestingly, Eddie Jones was, I got a hold of him and he was very good, and he made the point that what gets you the job also gets you the sack. And he was reading this in a book by Carlo Ancelotti on winning. And when he read it, he thought, I agree with that 100%. And he said, that's what happened to Joe. And you know what, mate, he says, it's going to happen to Andy too.
Okay, we'll come to the Andy thing in a moment. But what specifically about Joe do you think that was? Was that style of play? Was that personality?
It was the absolute rock solid self-belief in that what he was doing was right. So when it became wrong, he couldn't recognise that it was right. He simply doubled down.
Okay.
Work harder was often Joe's response to things.
And maybe he needed to take the foot off the pedal in terms of the pressure on the players a little bit?
Yes, no doubt.
So it was an intense environment in 19.
It was an extremely intense environment.
Andy Farrell, how's he going to get bitten by the thing that's surfing well?
Well, if the point that Eddie Jones is making, and this, he made that point to me, Owen, that was during the November series last year when we had that conversation. And he said, you can see it now in the way Ireland are playing, which was last November. And if you remember, people are going, geez, this doesn't look too good.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure how good it's going to look now in the wake of a Lions tour. But that Eddie's suggestion was that maybe Andy's camp needed a bit of the rigour of Joe's camp, which is understandable coming from Eddie Jones, whose camps were largely joyless. Mm-hmm. So I put that to David Nusafora, who loves Andy and was, you say, well, he would do, wouldn't he? Put him in there. But he firmly believes that Farrell has the ability to not do a chameleon on it, but to change whatever needs to be changed and to keep evolving and to keep ahead and keep fresh. The perhaps unique achievement that Farrell has on his CV now is that everybody who is in his camp, whether they're in the starting 15 or the starting 23, or I beg your pardon, starting 15, on the bench, or not in the 23, they all love him.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't add up in professional sport. You know the adage that everybody loves a coach until he picks a team. And yeah. Suddenly those who are not on the team sheet don't like him anymore. I've never come across anybody who is getting passed over for selection and starts and throws any rocks at Farrell. I spoke to a lot of people. Farrell wouldn't cooperate for the book. Understandably, he was writing his own book. Mm-hmm. I didn't come across anybody. The nearest I came to it was a fellow referring to a bit of forced fun with Andy at the start. This is when he was trying to revamp entirely the atmosphere.
In COVID.
And Joe, post-Joe.
Yeah.
So he would have been watching what Joe was doing. And I would have thought he would have picked the good bits, ditched the bad bits, and he would have got out of the blocks quicker when he succeeded. But he didn't. The first 18 months, we looked pretty poor.
Yeah.
And then they turned a corner. Then it came together one day against Japan. Okay, Japan. But it looked absolutely seamless.
England in 2021.
Yeah, but this was better.
Yeah, okay.
This was all the bits synced.
Yes, okay.
And funny, Stuart Lancaster had the Leicester squad in a couple of days later, and he said, that's it, they've nailed it.
Really?
Yeah.
That it is true. Like, is it because, and look, it's been a criticism of this November squad, is it because he does, to a degree, have a fairly tight squad? He knows what his best team is. It's quite Leinster-centric. We know who's in favour. We know who his players are. And there hasn't been a squad that he's ever announced in the last 4 or 5 years where there's been a bolt from the blue or a couple of selections that we really surprised with.
And Jack Crowley might have an issue with you there, but because yeah, Jack Crowley stepped in.
Yeah, he's still in the squad.
Yeah, but he did a really good job of following in Johnny's footsteps, which no easy feat.
Is that actually the one thing that might have changed opinion over the last 12 months, the perceived treatment of Jack Crowley?
No. I remember at that time thinking, God, if I was Jack Crowley, my nose would be out of joint. Or if I was Josh van der Fleer more recently in on the Lions tour and I wasn't getting a look in, and this guy's been picking me for every test match.
So is he just really good at dropping players?
I think he is. Have you ever interviewed him?
Only in
a group setting.
Group setting, yeah. I've never had a one-to-one with him, no.
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't read the book. And I don't know how. I hope it's not like Joe's book.
No,
if Joe gave nothing of himself in that book, and I don't know if Andy Farrell has.
Well, Joe didn't use a ghostwriter.
Enough about Andy Farrell's book.
Joe didn't use a ghostwriter, though, did he?
Joe didn't use a ghostwriter.
Yeah, see, that's it. Maybe that's why your profession will never go out. You'll sell a few extra copies by putting a little bit of glitz on it. A couple of final things. Really curious about this one. Maybe a little bit inside baseball, but how did Brendan Fanning, the Guardian writer, differ from Brendan Fanning, the Sunday Independent writer?
Oh.
More patriotic?
No. God. I don't think... it's a different operation.
You were that cold and there was no difference whatsoever?
No. I really loved, and I still write for The Guardian.
Yeah.
And they're great to deal with, and it's interesting how your work is handled by different people in a different environment, and the demands are different, and I don't know if I had to up my game, but I had to be careful, that's for sure. I didn't have the relationship with them that I did with my boss John Green in the Sunday Indo.
I do want to finish up on this. It's one of my favourite quotes in the book, page 107 at the start of Connacht. Mick Dawson, former Leinster CEO, we might need to bleep this. We knew we were stretched in 2016. We'd been beaten by Connacht in the final. I told my missus, if we were beaten by Connacht, I'm going to throw myself under a bus in Prince's Street, because I couldn't fucking imagine anything worse. And we were well beaten by them. Anyway, I missed the bus in Prince's Street.
Yeah. I know Mick from his days when he was working in Davy Stockbrokers. And he was always good company and entertaining, and he brought that into his long career as CEO in Leinster. And that's the way he talks, and he's good value.
Connacht's, the story of their rise is covered extensively in the book. I cannot get over the way in which votes and democracy were stacked against the province.
Yeah.
Remarkable, like they literally had fewer votes than the other three provinces.
I don't bother going to the AGM anymore, but I used to every year. And every time this was rolled out, what would happen was each province would nominate two people to go and sit in the committee, and then there were another six places up for grabs, and they would be voted in from the floor. And year after year, those six places were evenly divided between Munster, Ulster and Leinster. But the Connacht lads would go through the ritual of standing up and say, I'm nominating John Smith from Ballina or whatever. Blah, blah. And then he'd sit down again. And like it was just a complete charade. So it was apartheid, I suppose you could say.
When did that change?
I don't know. It's gone.
It is gone. Is there still a sense that they are outsiders?
Yes, there is. Because they don't generate... the crowds, well, this will, certainly Dexcom will help now, and their capacity will go up. They've always been the fourth province, and it's understandable in a country as small as ours and in a system as small as ours that should be the case. And their own stated ambitions, you ask Willie Rowan, their CEO, they're not going after marquee names. They're looking for diamonds in the rough. They're looking to grow more of their own, which they badly need to do, and they're looking to keep the door open to players typically in Leinster who are not getting a look in. That's they're the three prongs on their fork. They're not trying to get in a superstar who is going to cost them 500 grand a year.
It is called touching distance. I mean, you could easily take that and say that is Ireland's relationship with a World Cup semi-final. After all the research you've done, all the people you've spoken to, is that semi-final moment going to happen in 2027?
I can't say don't know. You'll say, why are you community? You're going to say it. Yes.
Why not? We'll get you back in 2 months when the World Cup draw has been done in December, and we'll have a much better idea of our path.
Yeah.
And no doubt some sort of injury crisis will break out in Australia in 2027 to keep us within touching distance. Irish Rugby's Battle with Great Expectations. It's absolutely fantastic. The author is Brendan Fanning, who you've been listening to for the last little while here in studio. Brendan, thanks a million for popping in.
Thank you, Owen. Really appreciate that.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Connacht, Leinster, Munster and Ulster Rugby. Never stop competing.